Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm Jessica Harris, and welcome to my welcome table. Gather around this special table. It's scarred with memories, pitted with burn spots from hot skillets, and decorated with moisture rings from frosty glasses of lemonade, beer bottles, bourbon and ginger ale, and untold goblets of red wine. This table will be our flying carpet as we travel around the world. I'll share some of my secret spots. We'll meet new friends and reconnect with old ones. Sometimes, the table will be covered with fine Porthot linen and my mother's bone china, and we'll sup on caviar and champagne. Other times, we'll cover it with yesterday's news and hanker down for a crawfish boil or a lobster supper. Whatever the meal, by the end of our time together, we'll have shared some special friends, sacred spots, and the food, drink, and music that connects them. So come, join me at my welcome table.
Hi, my name's Mitzi Pratt, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
I am Patrick Dunn, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is John Barkley, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is Anne McBride, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
I'm Betty Fussell, and I, too, am sitting at the welcome table.
Compass Point, 41.38 degrees north, 2.1 degrees east. Barcelona.
Where are you going?
Barcelona.
Barcelona. Barcelona. Barcelona.
Spain's second city, Barcelona, is the capital of the autonomous community of Catalonia and the largest metropolis on the Mediterranean coast. The city is at the same time deeply Spanish and yet something different. The Spain one sees in Barcelona is not the Spain of popular imagery. This is not the Spain of twisting alleyways that remind of Moroccan casbahs, nor is it the Spain of guitars strumming flamenco rasguillados while full gitanos wail the greatest hits of the cantejondo. I'm not joking about Andalusia. It will always be one of my favorite areas of Spain. But in Barcelona and in Catalonia, that Spain is left far behind. Barcelona offers something different, something less easily apprehended and perhaps felt more deeply. Barcelona is northern as opposed to southern, a bit more reserved and hidden, less easily understood, and more of an acquired taste. Yet once the taste is acquired, Barcelona will win your heart with its culture that is intensely Spanish, and yet manifestly also other.
The summer sun set a vicious circus when shadows held the world in place. But today I felt a chill in my apartment.
Founded in Roman times, Barcelona has always looked north, as well as south, and to the Mediterranean, as well as to the Iberian Peninsula. Legends about the city's founding, connected with Hercules, as well as with the father of Hannibal, the legendary Carthaginian general. In the Middle Ages, the city became the capital of the county of Barcelona, and later merged with the Kingdom of Aragon that later ruled much of the western Mediterranean. The cathedral, or the Basilica La Ciu, as it is also known, is the centerpiece of the town's historic center and is said to have been founded in 343 AD. Like all of Spain, Barcelona was conquered by the Arabs in the early 8th century. But unlike much of the rest of the country, it did not remain long under Arab rule, as it was then conquered by Charlemagne's son, Louis, in a move that set Catalonia on its path to uniqueness. In later years, that uniqueness was maintained by a fierce strain of Catalan separateness. The city and the area continue to celebrate their difference from the rest of the country with the use of the Catalan language and a vibrant cultural life that revels in the region's uniqueness.
Arteria y crisol llevan alegres impresas, caricias de luz y sol, y metidas por la brisa de canaletas al mar.
Pasear, the Spanish verb meaning to stroll, is perhaps the most quintessential Spanish means of locomotion. No matter what the town, dusk is certain to find hordes of Spanish families strolling the streets and boulevards, and Barcelona is no exception. In Barcelona, though, there is only one real place to begin strolling, Las Ramblas. Technically, Las Ramblas is a city of Rambla, each one leading into the next. Formerly a riverbed and then a watercourse for runoff after heavy rains, the route went from being an open sewer that flanked the walls of the old city to the peaceful promenade it currently is. Building actually began in the late 14th century, and the area became first the home to religious orders, and over the ensuing centuries, gradually became the city's centerpiece that it is today. The first trees were actually planted in the early 18th century, 1703 to be exact. Today, Las Ramblas begins for some at the old port, which is now used mainly for pleasure craft. The Rambla de Mar is a wooden walkway that was built in the 1990s and is considered by many the official beginning of the Ramblas. Purists, however, place the beginning of Las Ramblas at the Rambla Santa Monica, which is home to the former convent of Santa Monica that now houses an art center and a museum of contemporary art. It, in turn, leads to the Rambla de las Capuchines, site of a former Capuchin monastery that is now dominated by the opera house of Liceu that opened in 1847. It wends into the Rambla de las Flores, or the Rambla San Joseph, which is the site of an open-air flower market, and on beyond. Nearby, a quick turn down a side street takes you to the Boqueria Market, Barcelona's equivalent to Paris's Léal. First mentioned in 1217, the market evolved from stands by the gates to the medieval city where vendors sold meats. The market grew and prospered under several different names until 1840, when it was finally housed in an official structure. At origin, a market for meat and flower vendors, that's F-L-O-W-E-R, the market gradually grew to house not only fishmongers, but eventually fruit and vegetable vendors as well. Today, it's possible to take different types of food tours, ranging from a walking tour that gives a brief overview, to tours that offer visits to specialized areas, such as a sweets and bakery tour, a seafood tour, or a cheese and wine tour. Each of them dazzles with the diversity of product and the sheer abundance that is viewed in the market. Other tours are available as well through BoqueriaBites.com food tours, including a tapas tour and a gastronomic tour, each of which obviously offer tastes as well. If you're like me, there's no need for lunch after a lengthy stroll through the Boqueria. I'm a nibbler, and if there's a sample to be offered, I'll have it. If not, I'll find a way to buy just enough for a nibble and nosh my way into contentment. La Boqueria is perfect for this, and after an orienting tour, it's back to the places I really want to investigate. La Boqueria is perfect for this, and after an orienting tour, it's back to the places I really want to investigate for more nibbles and perhaps some real eating. Restaurants also abound in Barcelona, from spots that specialize in seafood like Passadilla de Pep, where you can indulge in crisp fried anchovies, and I dote on them. Or then there are places like Cutting Edge Arola, where Sergi Arola, a disciple of Fernand Adrián, works his magic in the kitchen. If you're searching for seafood, a place that will take you back in time to simpler days is El Rasal de Mariner. Fried octopus, perfectly fried fish that still tastes of its sea tang, and a sumptuous paella de mariscos are only some of the dishes available at this spot that is really only open from 5 a.m., for the late-night revelers who want their fried fish for breakfast, until 5 in the evening. Barcelona offers a seemingly unlimited array of eating options, from street nibbles through tapas to fine dining. But sooner or later, it's time for a little exercise, and time to head out to explore the city. Tibidabo offers a panoramic perch from which to get a vista of all that is Barcelona from sea to shore. But my favorite spot, one that evokes the uniqueness of the city and is a testimonial to the city's architectural genius, is the Parque Güell. Antonio Gaudí y Cornet was a Catalan architect whose work is classified by some as Art Nouveau, but is perhaps more accurately referred to with proper Catalan pride as Catalan Modernisme. His work reveals a deep appreciation of the flora of his native Catalonia and makes abundant use of sinuous curves adorned with stained glass, ceramic pieces, wrought and forged iron, and more. One of his first commissions was creating the lamppost for the Plaza Real in the center of town. He gained notice, however, and began getting significant commissions after he was hired to design the Casa Vicens. After exhibiting at the Paris World's Fair of 1878, he was hired by the Güell family to design for them, and he created wine cellars, a palace, and the crypt of their family church. More importantly, for the visitors to Barcelona, he also designed a park for them, the Parque Güell, a garden complex on the hill of El Carmel in the Gracia district. Benches in the form of sea serpents, visual symbols of Catalan nationalism, and iconography from the Roman Catholic faith are all evident in this complex that was originally conceived as a part of a project designed to be a housing estate for well-to-do Barcelona families. Unfortunately, there were no buyers. And although the project was begun in 1900, by 1914, only 2 homes out of the originally proposed 60 were sold, and the park became a private garden. After Güell's death in 1918, the park became a public park and remains so today. It is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it is a Barcelona must-visit spot for all. Gaudí becomes a bit of an obsession for any architecturally minded visitor to Barcelona, because his work and the exotic sinuosity of his Catalan modernist style are so unique. Visits to the Casa Batlló and the Casa Mia, two of his most emblematic works, are musts. But the work most connected with him, that has become a symbol of Barcelona, is the Basilica, Temple Expiatore de la Sagrada Familia, the Basilica and Expiatory Chapel of the Holy Family. Begun in 1883, the unfinished church is a monument to Gaudí's unique style and remains his unfinished masterwork. It has been called the most extraordinary personal interpretation of Gothic architecture since the modern ages by some. Others have called it sensual, spiritual, whimsical, and exuberant. But still others were less charitable, and George Orwell deemed it, and I quote, one of the most hideous buildings in the world, end quote. Whatever your opinion, the Sagrada Familia has undeniably become perhaps the most recognizable symbol of Barcelona, and along with the Parque Güell and five other sites designed by Gaudí, has been named UNESCO World Heritage Site. Unfinished at Gaudí's death in 1926, in a very strange streetcar accident, with construction further interrupted by the Civil War, the church is gradually being completed according to interpretations of Gaudí's plans. The originals were burned in a fire. The nave vaulting was completed in 2008. The main tower of Jesus Christ was finished in 2006. And the basilica itself was consecrated by Pope Benedict XVI in 2010. It's anticipated that the whole will be completed in 2026, a 21st century Gothic cathedral. Gaudí's love for the plants and animals of his native Catalonia is very much in evidence throughout the building. The columns of the Nativity facade are firmly planted on the backs of turtles, and the columns of the Passion facade are designed to resemble sequoia trees. It is a monumental work, a tribute to the genius of Gaudí, and a testimonial to his faith and his prides in things Catalan. Barcelona is an architect's delight for too many reasons to note. One, though, actually is the city's fourth most popular destination. The Poble Español, Pueblo Español in Spanish, is an open-air architectural museum that allows the visitor to explore the architectural diversity of the country while strolling among 117 replicas of buildings from all over Spain. Built for the 1929 Universal Exposition that was held in Barcelona, it has been maintained and is today a much-visited park that celebrates the country's architectural heritage. Want to see an 18th-century farmhouse from the Basque Country? It's there in full replica, as are the Calle Cuna from Arcos de la Frontera in Andalusia, and the Mudéjar Bell Tower from Utebo in Aragon, and the Plateresque Palacio de los Golfines from Abajo in Cáceres in Extremadura. The entrance is through the Puerto de San Vicente, a replica of the building in Ávila in Castilla y León. In addition to the architectural tour of Spain, the Pueblo Español offers restaurants celebrating Spain's diversity on the plate and boutiques showing the works of artisans from around the country. And often the artisans themselves are there to produce the goods. It's an inexpensive and fascinating way to visit many of the high points of Spanish culture in an afternoon. Barcelona and Catalonia are not only about architects. The city and the province have spawned more than their fair share of artists as well. Certainly, Salvador Dalí was the most flamboyant. He, of melting watches, was also a native son of Catalonia, as was Juan Miró, and Miró's foundation and museum are housed in Barcelona. Dalí's museums are not that far away in Figueres, where he was born and died, and in Puerto Ligat and Pubol. There's also a Dalí museum in St. Petersburg, Florida, a little closer to home, but that's another story and another show. But before there were Dalí and Miró, Paris was treated to the art and antics of another Catalan, Josep Maria Sert. He was an artist and an engraver, but it was his wife who served as models for artists ranging from Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec to Renoir. And it's not just the plastic arts that rule in Barcelona. A saying has it that if you find one Catalan, he'll form a business. Two, they'll form a corporation. And three, we'll form a choral society. Music just seems to flow in the veins of the Catalan. Choral music is especially loved. Patriotism, however, is never far away in Catalonia, and often, even when others are singing solos in a language in which the work was originally written. The chorus will accompany them resolutely, singing in Catalan. But in what luscious and lyric Catalan. Any visitor can delight in the multiplicity of musical events and concerts offered in the city that has often been called the Boston of Spain for its vibrant cultural life. But I've left my favorite part of the city for last. Yes, I know there's controversy about how Gothic the Barrio Gótico or Gothic neighborhood actually is. But hey, I like Williamsburg too. The cathedral's facade only dates to the latter part of the 19th century and the early 20th century. The Picasso Museum was restored in 1929, and the Royal Artists Circle was restored in 1970. But I was a theater major, and I really can appreciate a good stage set. Whatever its authenticity, the Gothic neighborhood gives a feel of what an old European medieval sound center must have been like, in ways that Paris, post Haussmann, does not offer. Walking through the narrow streets and dark alleyways where buildings block out the sunlight, you can sense what it must have been like to stroll with Cervantes. If you're fortunate and are in the Barrio Gótico on a Sunday, you might just turn the corner one morning around 11 o'clock and hear the whine of an oboe and the piping of a flute. Scurry and hurry to the Praça de Sió. It's the beginning of a sardana, the haunting lyrical dance that has come to symbolize Catalonia and the Catalan culture. Writer James Michener described it better than I ever could in Iberia, his masterwork on Spain that captures the ethos of the country in ways that still ring true even now, long after Franco's demise and more than 26 years after its original publication. Here's what he said. One Sunday morning, as I was walking through the Gothic quarter, of which I never saw enough, for it is not often that one finds in the heart of a modern city an ancient one, exciting as a kind of soul imprisoned in stone yet mysteriously vital. I heard the lovely sound of rustic pipes and muffled drums. I could have been in a woodland, except that the cathedral rose above me, and as I entered its plaza, I saw that several hundred people, or perhaps even 1,000, all dressed in Sunday clothes, had gathered about 2 orchestras that were playing a concert, while worshippers heading for the cathedral or coming from it after a mass passed by and nodded approvingly, even though the music was not religious. The orchestras were special. Each was composed of 12 members, 5 country oboes, 1 trombone, and 3 cornets and 2 fisk horns, which were small and gave forth piercing sounds. I was surprised to see that there were no drummers, for I thought I had heard drums. But when I approached the orchestra, I saw that the oboe players had tiny drums, not more than 3 inches across, strapped to their left forearms, and these they struck from time to time without interrupting their playing on oboes. One of the fisk horn players had a cymbal, even smaller, strapped to his wrist, and this he struck with another, which he held daintily between his fingers. The music these orchestras produced, one playing while the other rested, was delicate, and unlike any I'd heard before, the wedding of oboe and cornet being extremely pleasing. As I was watching the fisk horn players, for I had not before seen this instrument, a strange thing happened all around me. A moment ago, the Catalans in the plaza had been listening to the sardana. Now, without anyone having given a signal, circles formed, containing men and women of all ages down to 8 years old, so that the entire plaza was covered with people silently performing the folk dance that accompanies the sardana. I was astonished at how quietly this had happened, for there were at least 11 of these large circles, some with 30 members, and the dance was vigorous and beautiful, yet how it started, I couldn't say. The sardana was like the movement of an animated clock that ran in both directions, slow steps left, slow steps right, left, right, left, right, with arms held closely to the side, then faster steps with hands slightly raised, then fast, intricate steps with hands held high above the head and body swaying beautifully as the tempo of the music increased. Finally, the entire plaza was in motion, with worshippers filing in and out of the cathedral and stopping to join the dance if they felt so inspired. Then a tinkling clang of the tiny cymbals, a ruffle on the toy drums, a wail on the oboes, and the dance ended. In a flash of movement, the circles disbanded, and the plaza was both silent and sedate for Sunday morning. After 10 or 15 minutes' rest, the second orchestra began, and the dance was underway once more. But the music stops, just as mysteriously as it forms. It stops, and people disperse to go about their daily lives. And it's time for me to leave the haunting city of sardanas and singers, of architects and artists, where a stroll can lead to a museum or a market, or a town square where families, friends, and perfect and imperfect strangers come together to support each other in the dance. So, until next time.
Keep on killing good and greasy when I'm gone, gone, gone. Keep on killing good and greasy when I'm gone.